KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Up front this week, Texas Republicans blame President Joe Biden's immigration policies for the rise in teens and families arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border in the last few months. Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez profiles two teenage migrants who have a different perspective.
In early March, 17-year-old Josue said goodbye to his family of farmers in El Salvador and headed to the United States in search of work. He paid smugglers to take him, and they dropped him off in El Paso near the border wall. He says Border Patrol officers took him to a holding facility where he was given new clothes. He says he was held at the facility for 4 days and then taken to the Freeman Coliseum in San Antonio. It's one of 10 emergency shelters in Texas that was opened by the Biden administration to house a large number of minors crossing the border without their parents. He says he has been treated well by both staff at the Border Patrol facility and at the Freeman Coliseum shelter run by the federal government. Josue says at the Border Patrol facility, he slept on mats on the floor. At the Freeman Coliseum, he says, they had beds and more food. But the Coliseum is only for teenage boys. And while there, Josue turned 18 and had to leave. He was taken in by Catholic Charities, where he was able to meet with reporters. Also there was Eric, who also turned 18. Both of them look much younger than 18. They are clean-cut and both have a shy smile. Both say they are anxious to get to work and send money back to their families. Josue says his family in El Salvador is very poor, and for Eric, his goal was to come to the U.S. to study. Back in Guatemala, Eric says he had to focus on helping his family and father by growing beans and corn on their small plot of land. His father has been unable to work because he's in a wheelchair. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has used migrants like Josue and Eric as examples to campaign against President Joe Biden and his immigration policies.
The Biden administration caused this crisis and has repeatedly failed to address it.
Eric and Josue say they heard about President Biden, but only when they got to the U.S. They don't know much about border policies or Biden's decision to allow migrant minors into the U.S. and seek asylum. When asked if they're going to seek asylum, they don't say anything. They were confused. They say they just plan to reconnect with relatives in New York and Iowa. Josue says it's been a long journey and he hears migrants have been sent back, which is devastating, and he hopes the new administration will continue to allow kids into the U.S. so they can have a better life. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
Members of the Las Cruces City Council voiced their support this week to limit the use of plastic bags. Madison Staten has more.
Stores in Las Cruces may soon be switching to a paper bagging system as part of a proposed city effort to limit single-use plastics. While an official ordinance has yet to be drafted, City Sustainability Officer Lisa LaRocque reviewed a proposed plan with the Las Cruces City Council during a work session. She outlined the reasons single-use plastic bags can be harmful, saying they are often only in use for an average of 12 minutes.
Litter and plastics buried in the landfill can persist there for hundreds of years. And we have this throwaway mentality that needs to be stopped. On average, we use 1,500 single plastic-use plastic bags a year, and on average, we use them for only 12 minutes. So it is a very excessive use of a product that has such a long shelf life.
The proposed plan would ban single-use plastic bags in department, grocery, and other stores, but would make exceptions for food banks, restaurants, and takeout establishments. To help offset the cost of paper bags, LaRock proposed a 10-cent fee for each bag used.
50% of the bag fee will be kept by the retailers to offset the added cost of paper bags and to assist with administrative fees. And the remaining 50%, we suggest, should be donated to a local nonprofit chosen by the retailer.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima says he would support the plan if restaurants were not included in the plastic ban, though indicated he would be open to reevaluating the ordinance at the one-year mark.
It's an additional cost right now when restaurants don't need it. You know, paper bags are expensive. Yeah, that's why I said, let's revisit in a year. Yeah, but if we put it in there, then it's going to have to be done. What was presented, I like.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo says that while she is open to a phased-in approach, her goal is to ultimately see the plastic ban expanded to include restaurants.
The intention of this ordinance is not to place a burden on anybody. The intention of this ordinance is to ensure our landfills don't look like they currently do. Our desert doesn't look like our currently do. It's a much broader intent.
But researchers, like University of Sydney economist Rebecca Taylor, say that bans on plastic bags have historically led to an increase in other plastic purchases. She told NPR in 2019 that 4-gallon trash bag purchases had an increase in sales of approximately 120% in the California region studied after a ban was put in place. The National Resources Defense Council says that even with the spike in garbage bag sales, less plastic was used in the studied regions overall. The NRDC stressed that the key to a good plastic bag ban is finding solutions to avoid a surge in paper bag use, citing a need for measures like paper bag fees. Statewide bans have been increasingly common across the United States. 8 states, including California, Oregon, New York, and Hawaii, have all enacted legislation banning plastic bags. The city of Albuquerque has also implemented a ban on plastic bags, electing to exempt restaurants from the policy. Due to the pandemic, the ban was temporarily suspended in the spring of 2020. Councilor Gabe Vasquez says that the city of Las Cruces is lagging behind the rest of the state in enacting a plastic bag ban. He stresses a citywide campaign to promote reusable bags will be key in educating community members.
I think now is an opportune time to talk about banning plastic bags. I know you guys have all seen what I-10 and I-25 and literally almost every major street looks like in Las Cruces right now. Completely littered with plastic, every single corner of our city right now.
Vasquez says that a plastic bag ban should simply be a jumping off point for the city, and that a ban on other single-use plastics should be explored in the future.
I would love to also have an ordinance on styrofoam and other single-use reusables or single-use plastics like straws and other types of things like that here. I think this is a start, and I think it's part of the culture shift that it's going to take for us to get to where we want to get as a community and as a planet.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
To state politics now, and legislation passed this year means terminally ill patients in New Mexico will soon be able to use medication to allow for a peaceful death. More from the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown.
Kim Callanan with the Compassion and Choices Action Network says by passing the bill, New Mexico becomes the 10th state to embrace an end-of-life choice.
When people find out that they have a terminal prognosis, one of the biggest concerns is, will I have to suffer at the end? This legislation allows a person to avoid the very worst, the very last part of the dying process.
The new law contains strict eligibility requirements and safeguards to regulate the practice. Elizabeth Armijo with Albuquerque's Compassion and Choices Action Network says some terminally ill patients in other states have elected not to use the medication, but having it gives them peace of mind.
We expect that they do it in consultation with their family, with their loved ones, or with their faith leaders. But at the end of the day, it's really about that individual's decision, and it's their complete autonomy.
The New Mexico bill was named for Elizabeth Whitefield, an Albuquerque family judge and attorney who advocated for a version of the bill before losing an 11-year battle with cancer in 2018. Kellen Ann says deaths among the elderly from COVID-19 may be increasing momentum for end-of-life options, but she also believes there's a generational component.
You're in the sandwich generation now with the baby boomers who are contemplating their own mortality while also caring for their elderly parents, and they're seeing the travesty of loved ones suffering unnecessarily at life's end.
The new law is modeled after Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. Colorado has a similar law, and a comparable bill is now before the Nevada legislature. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
In the wake of the Capitol insurrection, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin directed military leaders to meet with their units to talk about what extremism is and how to respond to it. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame talked with service members at Joint Base San Antonio about what they got from the experience.
In the 2 decades he spent in the Air Force, Maurice Jeter says he never saw radical displays of extremism.
The most I've seen, and this was back in the late 90s, you may be in the dorms or the barracks and someone might have a Confederate flag hanging up.
Jeter, who is black, worked as a personnelist in multiple theaters and combat zones, and he would sometimes ask his fellow airmen why they hung it up.
They had other reasons for having it, as they said, a Southern culture thing, not necessarily they were looking to be violent or overthrow the government.
But as society changed, Jeter says he stopped seeing flags or other symbols of hate displayed openly in the Air Force. So when rioters in support of former President Donald Trump swarmed the Capitol in January, he was stunned, especially when he learned that many of them had military ties.
We were all in shock and disbelief.
Jeter's now a civilian employee of the 502nd Air Base Wing at Joint Base San Antonio. He says while people he talks to on base have different political views, they agree on a few things.
That storming the Capitol was the wrong thing to do, was the wrong way about getting your message across. And for those who were veterans who were currently serving, we kind of felt like they dishonored their oath and their commitment to this country.
Top military leaders wanted to make sure these conversations were happening in the ranks, so they ordered units large and small to hold stand-down events on extremism. They've happened across the country over the last several weeks.
Okay, so goals for today, we're going to review and discuss the oath of office. Then we're going to talk about impermissible behaviors. What are they? You know, everyone talks about that, but what does that mean? There's a continuum of those, and so we'll work through that continuum.
In a conference room at Fort Sam Houston, Joint Base San Antonio head General Caroline Miller briefs a socially distanced group of commanders from the 502nd Air Base Wing.
We have to make sure that we do trust each other, so when the time comes if something catastrophic is going on, that you trust your neighbor. And if there's bias, if there's racism, then it's not going to work.
The stand-downs didn't all look the same. But most talked through different ways of identifying extremists, ran through scenarios, as well as what counts as active participation in an extremist group. Some also went over hate symbols like the swastika and tactics used by conspiracy theory groups like QAnon. Maurice Jeter took part in a stand down too. He says they talked through a situation where a service member was using a government network to look at extremist content on his cell phone.
So that initiated the conversation of, you know, if I were to walk into that room with this individual watching this video, kind of how would I react?
The Department of the Air Force calls extremism a common belief which might otherwise be politically or socially acceptable, but which espouses the use or threat of force or violence to obtain their goals. But there's still a lot of gray area.
I don't know that you can really just pinpoint all of the red flags that someone can exhibit.
Master Sergeant Victoria Yale works as a part of the JBSA commander's staff.
Sometimes I think you can be wrong. How do you identify them without being, you know, maybe stereotypical or have some unconscious bias or whatever?
She says it's important for service members to elevate their concerns about extremism and ask for help.
Sometimes just simply trusting your gut instinct can be enough to maybe just open the door a little bit and say, hey, this is how I feel. I don't feel right about this. I don't know if it's anything, but I think it's worth asking the question.
Yale herself says she hasn't seen any examples of extremism while in service, but in future, she says she'll be more vigilant. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Texas House leaders have put a roster of health care bills at the top of their priority list for this year's legislative session. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the bills cover a wide range of issues, but don't include Medicaid expansion.
Texas House Speaker Dade Phelan announced he's prioritizing bills that tackle health equity issues, support for mental health, vaccines, maternal mortality, telehealth services, and prescription drugs, as well as health care coverage for children. But in that long list, Phelan did not include a big-ticket item health care advocates have been urging lawmakers to consider, and that's expanding Medicaid to more low-income people in the state. Phelan says it will likely come up as they talk about other health care issues.
We will have that debate. We always do in the House. And we had it last session. We've had it every session since I've been in this building.
But there's still no support among leadership to get Medicaid expansion passed. Texas is one of just 12 states that has not expanded Medicaid, even though we have the highest uninsured rate in the country. This year, Congress also offered Texas a huge financial incentive to expand Medicaid on top of paying for almost all of the expansion. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
1 year ago, 10,000 cars waited hours to receive food in a flea market parking lot in San Antonio. The iconic image made news across the globe. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav tells us while that photo showed how quickly hunger increased, it isn't falling that way.
Norma Vasquez is waiting in a line of cars at a park on San Antonio's southwest side. She's waiting for food in what has become a humid day.
Wow, how are we doing today?
I'm doing good, Mija.
Good. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and get you checked in.
Okay.
How many in your house?
Me and my son.
Vasquez says she's sat in lines like this more than a dozen times since the pandemic began. The woman in her 60s on disability says she's grateful for the help and happy the line isn't too long. It's about 100 cars. And doesn't compare to what it was like a year ago. She remembers seeing the thousands of cars crammed together.
I just said, wow! I said, but well, we got tacos, mija, we got a soda, so we'll be okay.
That day, it took her 3 hours to receive the boxes of food, as volunteers and employees of the San Antonio Food Bank worked to feed 10,000 families. But a year later, she's still in line. Today, she's one of more than 2.2 million Texans, more than 1 in 10 surveyed, who the census says doesn't have enough to eat. So while unemployment's been cut in half the past few months, that hasn't lessened the need in Texas and elsewhere for food assistance.
All right, so we have some veggies here. We have bell peppers, we have grapes, salad, tomatoes, lettuce.
Volunteer Bianca Rosales describes the fresh produce they're giving away. The food bank does one large distribution a week and has as many as 20 smaller ones like this one to try and keep up.
Today, so luckily we have a good line and we can get these out pretty quickly because it's pretty hot out here.
Hello, ma'am, a couple more bags.
Marisela Morales borrowed her brother's car to pick up food for herself and her three kids at the food bank.
I'm gonna give you the eggs up in the front.
Morales says increased payments from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and renewed pandemic food benefits for her school-aged children help, but they still struggle.
The stimulus check that I received, I was behind about $2,000 in rent, so that's what I did with that. But we have a roof over our heads, so. I don't complain about it.
San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper says February's deadly winter storms in Texas added to the struggles. And despite stock market and job gains, he still needs 2,000 volunteers a week. His food bank still serves around double pre-pandemic numbers, about 120,000 people a week.
So I thought maybe I could understand when stimulus checks hit, surely the lines will be shorter, but they weren't. When the extra unemployment ran out, surely my line would be longer, but it wasn't. It's just stayed fairly constant.
There is hope. The census shows that since December, the number of people who didn't have enough to eat dropped by more than 10 million. And finally, food insecurity is consistently improving for Black and Brown families, where it was most dire. And the White House changes to things like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which sends more money to families with kids.
When you sort of pull in all of the different aspects of this relief payments, it's expected to reduce child poverty by more than half next year. That can make somebody pretty excited.
Diane Schanzenbach is director of Northwestern's Institute for Policy Research. She's optimistic, but
one thing I'm really worried about is, are we going to run out of energy for continuing to provide relief? before the need is no longer elevated.
Recessions, she says, always last longer for the poor. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
To commentary now, and more people are getting the COVID-19 vaccination. But there are many other pandemic-related issues to sort out. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
I'm scheduled to get my second COVID-19 shot Friday, meaning I'll be fully vaccinated in a couple of weeks. The pandemic, for me, is almost over, and I'm incredibly grateful to the brilliant men and women who developed these safe and effective vaccines. But this doesn't feel like a victory. Until March of last year, Americans saw pandemics as something that happens every few years in Africa or Asia. The notion of more than 562,000 U.S. deaths, and still growing every day, was inconceivable then. We've been living with the mounting death toll for more than a year now, but we're no closer to having a unified strategy to defeat the virus now than we were at the start. Even with the benefit of hindsight, there's no agreement as to what we would have done differently if we had the chance. That's understandable, given the different impact the pandemic has had on people's lives. The virus hit right as I was settling into retirement. It was easy for me to urge a more cautious approach because those business closures didn't hurt me financially. Other people had different circumstances. Beyond that, there's the apparent random nature of the virus. Those urging more restrictions like to point to New Zealand as the model for how it should have been done. An early shutdown, strictly enforced, has allowed them to return to normal life. But how do they explain Texas? Cases have gone down in the Lone Star State in the weeks since Governor Greg Abbott has lifted restrictions there. I still think that was a bad idea, but the only way I can be proven right is for more people to get sick. So I hope I'm wrong. Becoming fully vaccinated will allow me to more freely interact with others, but we'll still be in a pandemic until enough people get the vaccination to stop the spread. For the next couple of months, vaccine supply will be the primary factor limiting how many people can get the shot each day. But by the end of spring, the primary limiting factor will be fear of the unknown and distrust of government, which will lead to the next big argument. We can't force people to take a vaccination against their will, but is it reasonable to restrict their access to travel and public places if they refuse? Even after we gain control of the virus here, ultimate victory will not come until we gain control of it everywhere, and that would still appear to be years away. My hope is that those with more knowledge and responsibility are learning from past mistakes and will be better prepared for the next health crisis. My fear is that only half the country will listen to them. But that's for tomorrow. For today, there's a small, personal victory to be celebrated. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's comments are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. This is KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Some faith communities say restrictive election bills before the Texas legislature will disenfranchise both rural and urban voters. More from Roz Brown at the Texas News Service.
Texas Republicans last week advanced bills that would limit early voting hours, prohibit drive-through voting, and give partisan poll workers the ability to videotape voters at the polls. Bea Moorhead with Texas Impacts says many think the proposed laws are diversions from larger problems facing Texas, but she believes voting suppression is much more about the numbers of young people of color in Texas soon to be of voting age.
Voter suppression in the current environment is not about distracting people from things that already happened. It's about a thumb on the scale of what could happen in the future.
Republican lawmakers in Texas, much like their counterparts in Georgia, say the new voting bills are necessary to improve trust and confidence in the outcome of elections. At a recent House committee meeting, Texas Impact Advocacy Director Joshua Houston told lawmakers that HB 6 is so unclear, it appears members of his group would be breaking the law by assisting voters who seek help.
Under the language, we would be felons for distributing mail-in ballot applications during a local ballot initiative or constitutional amendment election if we have taken a position for or against that measure.
Moorhead says voters have shown no intention of fraud and shouldn't have to jump through hoops to exercise their constitutional right.
Faith communities look with deep suspicion on legislative proposals that exclude people from the process because we know exclusion in all of our scriptural traditions ends badly for the excluders.
Governor Greg Abbott has said he believes there was fraud in the 2020 presidential election, but not in Texas. On Monday, the Senate unanimously passed two election security bills, one requiring that a paper record be created of every ballot that is cast, and another creating a ballot auditing system. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Well, more on this issue now. Voting rights groups in Texas are asking corporations in the state to apply pressure against Republican bills that would restrict voter access. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the groups say they want corporations not only to speak out against the bills, but also to stop political contributions to lawmakers who vote for them.
Voting advocates want corporations to speak out against bills that would create new criminal penalties for voting, create more rules and regulations for voters who require assistance at the polls, and would limit what local election officials can do to expand access to the ballot in their counties. Charlie Bonner, a spokesperson with Move Texas, says the bills are racist and amount to voter suppression. He says corporations should do what they can to stop them from becoming law.
You cannot sit on the sidelines. You're either defending voting rights or you support voter suppression.
Republican leaders like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick accuse companies that have already spoken out of meddling. He argues the bills don't restrict voting in the state and that corporations should stay out of this political fight because he says the CEOs don't know what they're talking about. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Another commentary now. Doña Ana County is considering a contract with a nonprofit that aims to increase dog adoptions, but some are concerned about the plans. Some thoughts from commentator Peter Goodman.
Our county is working on a sole source contract with an entity called Barkhouse to help decrease our homeless dog population, partly by transporting dogs to other states for adoption. Some say competitive bidding would be fairer and may be legally required. There are other legal issues, including Barkhouse's involvement in preparing the plan, the omnipresent anti-donation clause, and questions about how the Barkhouse entity got set up. Barkhouse is Kelly M. Barker. Some say she's caring, creative, and uniquely capable of doing the job. Others say she's not sufficiently careful about dogs' health or about truth-telling. I tried to ask her, but lawyers apparently vetoed that idea. Michigan public records show that a couple sued her for fraud and breach of contract, alleging she'd promised their money would be safely in escrow and then secured by property in Dubai. Didn't happen. They won a default judgment in 2009. Barker has several entities, including three that are or were nonprofits, Global Flying Hospitals in Florida, and Uncaged Paws, one in Florida and one here. Barker's apparent response to questions concerns me. When someone asked to see papers a nonprofit is supposed to produce, Ms. Barker allegedly contacted a third party to attack the questioner. One woman who'd raised questions about Barkhouse received a lawyer's letter that appeared intended to threaten, but seemed somewhat silly. It ordered her to cease and desist her, quote, harassment, unquote, which I think was posting questions and criticism on Facebook. But it's the dogs that matter. Recently, Barkhouse sent 30-some puppies and their moms to a rescuer in Boulder, Colorado. The recipient says Barker promised the pups were healthy and would come with full papers on vaccinations and such. Unfortunately, dogs were ill and papers were missing. 2 hours after arrival, the first puppy died. Others followed. When the recipient sent Barker what she referred to as a frustrated message, Barker allegedly responded by posting on Facebook an old negative review of the recipient rescuer. A woman there wrote the county that she wished she could say that Barkhouse, if better organized, quote, could do great things. But the bottom line is, that's not true. They lied. They hid the fact puppies were sick, took young pups away from their moms, and were the direct cause of the deaths of all these pups, unquote. All these look like huge red flags, or at least yellow caution flags. Dogs and taxpayers deserve a careful decision here.
Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. More than two decades ago, then New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson called for the legalization of adult-use cannabis. What is he saying now that the legislature has voted to approve the idea? Johnson talked with Andy Lyman and Megan Kamrick on the New Mexico PBS podcast, Growing Forward.
Can you tell us what made you at that time kind of come out publicly to advocate for legalization and what you hoped the legislature might do with that message?
Well, the recognition that at that time half, and not that it's changed that much, but half of what we spend on law enforcement, the courts, and the prisons is drug related, and what are we getting for that? And the recognition that these laws are terribly discriminatory, and then the notion that I believe that and this is what I said in 1999, that I believe legalizing marijuana will lead to less overall substance abuse because people are going to find marijuana as such a safer alternative.
So it was kind of a long shot, I think, at the time, but was there any part of you that hoped that maybe you could get some Republican support, maybe even Democratic support at that time in the legislature to say, hey, maybe we should take a look at this?
No, Andy, there was absolutely no, I mean, everybody was throwing stones, everybody, Democrats, Republicans, there was, there was talk of impeachment. Gee, you're going to get impeached for voicing an opinion on a topic that you are an elected official, and aren't you supposed to get into office and do the things that you find out that need doing and do them? So, no, there was no chance whatsoever that this was going to go anywhere at the time. And I wasn't naive at the time, and but at the time, I did say that marijuana will be legalized. There's no question about it. The question is, how long will it take?
You've previously said that you were an occasional consumer of cannabis. Is that still the case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I also, my whole life is health and wellness. That's what my whole life is about. I haven't had a drink in 34 years. But I do find marijuana as a much safer alternative. And for me, marijuana is health and wellness. I think one of the offshoots of legalizing marijuana in a state where it hasn't been legal is I think a lot of people comply with the law and have never used marijuana because it's been illegal. I think one of the big surprises is going to be because it's legal, people are going to try it for the first time. And I think the takeaway is going to be, what have we done to this point? Because this is pleasant. This is a good thing. This isn't a bad thing.
Why do you like to use cannabis? Do you use it for medical reasons or other reasons?
Well, for the same reasons that someone would have a cocktail in the evening or a couple of cocktails to take the I don't know, the edge off the day. I think I'm in that category when it comes to marijuana. And I'll also say that, you know, the stories abound from people who have used marijuana and said they've had a horrible experience. How much of that had to do with the fact that it was illegal and that you had to buy it through the black market? I think a lot of those stories come from back to the fact that it was criminal, And because of that, people didn't use it. And that's going to change.
It's so interesting you bring that up. It's such a cultural shift. You don't think twice about, you know, saying, well, I came home and had a cocktail. You know, I mean, that's such a normal thing in American culture, for good or for bad. So you're seeing that, maybe see a shift like that with cannabis.
Well, and when people, this is my opinion, when people start to use cannabis on a more regular basis, they're going to stop you know, opioid addiction, when Trump says, I'm challenging the pharmaceutical industries of America to come up with a non-addictive, effective replacement for opioids, I'm screaming, it's here already, you know, cannabis. And that's what people are going to find. People are going to find this as a much safer alternative than opioids, than alcohol, than other drugs. And other drugs, what do other drugs have to do with? Well, the person that sells marijuana also sells harder drugs. That's the person you have to go to. That goes away when you legalize marijuana and it's now available at a store. And I also really want to applaud the governor for calling a special session on this and getting it done. I think that was terrific. I applaud the fact that it's going to be a really cheap license to produce or actually sell. I know that there are warts on everything. The wart on this bill seems to be putting a cap on production. This can be remedied, this can be amended in the future to take care of that issue.
It's interesting you brought up that you praised the current governor for doing that. As a self-described fiscal conservative, does it seem to you that the cost of the special session is negligible when it comes to the cost of, you know, legalizing this substance?
I do believe that, Andy. I absolutely do. And you know, people ask all the time, well, gee, there's all this revenue from, from the taxes. Well, forget about the revenue. Just think of the savings when it comes to law enforcement, the courts and the prisons. If the police can deal with real crime, and real crime, definitionally speaking, that's when you do harm to somebody else. If you're doing arguably just harm to yourself by using marijuana, who cares? Who really cares?
So Megan kind of brought this up partway as far as, you know, the stigma of using cannabis versus alcohol. You don't really see this with alcohol, but there's a long-running stereotype that people who use cannabis are spacey or forgetful or maybe have no filter. And it seems to me you're kind of unfiltered anyway by nature. But I often hear people relate cannabis use to your comments in the news and interviews. Does it ever bother you that when these interview clips come out, people say, oh, he's just smoke too much weed?
Well, okay, so this is where we've gotten to now. Look, I don't want to be a hypocrite, and I never have been a hypocrite. When I ran for governor the first time and I admitted marijuana use, there were so many that wanted to know if I'd been in drug rehab and was I remorseful for my marijuana use. Come on. At the time, I said, look, I'm one of 100 million Americans who've tried marijuana or used it, tens of millions that use it on a regular basis. You can criticize me for using it, but am I criminal? No. And then that's back to the discriminatory nature of the law to begin with. You know what? I'm caught with marijuana as a teenager growing up. I'm white. I got a job. I'm going to school. I live in Albuquerque. Good chance just drive on down the road and don't do it again, as opposed to someone black or of color, Hispanic, pulled over. The car smells of weed. Okay, we're going to put this guy through the ringer. And they do. And I don't want to fault law enforcement in any of this either. These are laws that needed to be changed. And of course, that is the law that we change. I was talking to a congressional candidate this cycle, And she said that she'd been in law enforcement her entire life. Look, you're not running for law. You're not running for sheriff here. You're running for Congress, and you're going to be put in a position to change laws that shouldn't exist, not to enforce laws that are, in fact, discriminatory and don't do any good whatsoever, do more harm than good.
Speaking of law enforcement, we know Darren White, your former Department of Public Safety Secretary, quit after you made that announcement about cannabis when you were governor. White has since changed his stance on cannabis and has a hand as a medical cannabis producer in New Mexico. But what are some of the other reactions that you got to your call for legalization?
Well, actually, it was a big surprise when I called for legalization, not being naive. I don't think I'm naive. I really thought, and this was a different time, 1999, that faxes, phone calls, emails, letters to the governor, I thought that this was going to run like a 90 to 10 negative. I really did. And it turned out to be 95 to 5 positive from all over the world. And the input from the world quadrupled overnight because of the stance that I took on marijuana. So I, right off the bat, recognized that, whoa, I'm talking about something that really needs to be talked about and nobody else is.
Oregon has gone a step farther now, step further, and decriminalized all drugs. And this is sort of, opponents of legalizing cannabis bring up these things as kind of a worst case scenario in terms of opening the door to other things. But what do you think? Would you support a more lenient attitude to other drugs?
Absolutely. And Megan, one of the things that I have said from day one is that, first of all, from day one, I said, all I am advocating for is the legalization of marijuana. But when we do that, we're going to enlighten ourselves on drug policy, drug laws, and eventually it will lead to decriminalization, legalization of all drugs. But that is probably not going to happen in my lifetime. But it's positive. I'm back to this. Look, if you're doing no harm to anyone arguably other than yourself, why are you not allowed to live your life with that freedom?
Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, always interesting. The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces a year ago, and every week we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Korean War veteran Ben Bell is interviewed by his friend, Jeff Schwain.
I grew up in a North Inch, and that's about it. I can't understand why I'm choking up, but then went to a boys' home.
Where was the orphanage and boys' home?
Pineville, Louisiana.
Okay. Are there some things in your life that you're particularly proud of?
I can't think of any.
Some kind of work or...
Well, I liked my job.
And what did you do?
I've done a lot of things. I was a salesman, and from there I went into pipe fitting. Traveled all over, working on nuclear power plants.
So what year did you go into the service, and which branch did you go into?
I went into the Army in 1952.
Did you volunteer or were you drafted?
I was drafted.
How did you imagine military life would be before you joined?
I never had a problem with that because I was raised in a type of military situation, regimental all the time.
Tell me a little bit about what basic training was like for you after you joined the Army.
Well, basic training was a little different than I expected it to be. But it prepared me for what I had to do.
Do you remember any humorous incidents from basic training that kind of stick with you?
No, it was all misery.
Do you remember finding out where you were going to be sent after basic training? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. They gave us orders to ship us to the Far East, and I knew that was the end of the line.
In what sense?
Well, I knew that I wasn't going to get good duty. I knew I was going into a combat zone.
When you traveled to Korea, how did you get there?
I got there by a troop ship, and we hit the tail end of a typhoon, and I thought the ship was going to sink because the screws would come up out of the water and it would just vibrate. Then we landed in Japan. That was our first deal, and then we got all the gear for combat, rifle, ammo.
And how did you get from Japan to Korea then?
On another ship.
Okay. No typhoon this time, though.
No, no, no. And I said, I made a vow that I would never get on another ship. I didn't know how I would get home, but I wasn't going to go get it on another ship.
Do you remember about that in terms of getting yourself situated up there?
Well, I remember as soon as we got up to the front, it was kind of late, and they said, okay, you got to dig in. I started digging in, but it wasn't, I guess I thought it was, you know, kind of like a joke. I wasn't scared then. And then they come down and they said, you didn't get deep enough. I said, well, we aren't going to be here very long. So he said, you're going to be here a while. So you better dig that hole so you can cover yourself without getting your head out of it. I thought, my goodness. And you had a little entrenching tool to. But I really didn't dig it that deep because you can't dig too good in that soil with an entrenching tool. And it was just, you could lay down in it and that would protect you, but that's just about what I dug until they started shelling us, and then you dug a little deeper.
More motivation, huh?
Yeah.
Did you return to the United States on a boat?
I sure did, because when they said, Bill, you can go home, I said, where's that boat?
Do you think you would have swum back if
I would have got on my log and pedaled back.
So anything else you'd like to say about this experience you had fighting to defend the country? Any other word or?
I would not trade the experience for $1 million, but I wouldn't take $1 million to go back.
Korean War vet Ben Bell. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Finally, a local organization is working to connect border communities in our region to our public lands. To learn more, Anthony Moreno talked with Nuestra Tierra President Angel Peña.
There's been criticism in the outdoor agencies and also the outdoor industry about it not being diverse enough and reflecting the United States and the diversity that it has. What are your thoughts on this, and how does your organization try to address that issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Because you're my gente, right? This is my community. I'm going to be completely honest. I've been working in the conservation space for over a decade, right? And initially, I was really excited to be and have the opportunity to advocate for our beautiful places and for our dense culture and traditions. And then it was took a couple years, almost a decade, to identify that I might have been tokenized. I might have been the articulate brown kid, especially over a decade ago. I was much more articulate, much more younger. But in all seriousness, that's why we pulled the Nuestra Tierra Conservation Project together. It is a brown idea, led by raza, led by gente, staffed 100% by those people on the ground who have everything to lose. And so we're very excited to be able to no longer tokenize, but simply elevate and amplify those voices on the ground that live there and have everything to lose, Anthony.
Share with us a little bit about the history of your organization. Can you share with us a little bit about the history and events that you hold and how you connect with youth in our community?
Absolutely. So we started off by with a simple objective to ensure that our community youth had access to the outdoors and that we were able to break down barriers such as equipment or just transportation is something that's very real. Even though that here in Doña Ana County, we are surrounded by public lands, transportation is something very real that our youth can access, right? And so that's kind of how we got our chops going and built a little bit of our reputation, especially now during COVID-19. It was hard to engage and cultivate community in the good old-fashioned way of just filling the truck up with all sorts of people and creating adventures, right, and building memories with one another. 2020 really allowed us the space to kind of acknowledge and call out that we as a single organization could never truly empower and get our youth out in the numbers that we needed to. So we began to look at the tools in our tool belt. And that's when we identified as policy. Politics is a real answer. So we proudly pulled together the team, that authentic team built on real relationships that introduced and then secured the first of its kind New Mexico Outdoor Equity Fund, where it's a state program where its sole purpose is to help get kids outside. You know, this is a state grant program that can provide resources for anything from appropriate hiking shoes, socks, to putting gasoline or diesel in that car, in that troca, you know, to break down and to create access.
So New Mexico lawmakers created the Outdoor Recreation Department, the Equity Fund, and have been able to help fund events and organizations and support organizations like yours and throughout the state of New Mexico. Can you kind of give us a better understanding of the Equity Fund and why it's needed?
So the New Mexico Outdoor Equity Fund was built by visionary leaders, you know, that were working in these communities and had identified and really understood the need and how to fill that gap. And so that's when the New Mexico Outdoor Equity Fund was created. And a vision without resources is little more than a hallucination, Anthony, right? Yeah. I think we can all admit that. And when we identify that that the need was much more greater than the state capacity at the time, we worked really hard with communities, especially off the I-25 corridor, to tell that story and elevate that story. And just this year, we were able to, I think, quadruple the resources within the New Mexico Outdoor Equity Fund so we can get tens of thousands of kiddos out on the ground in real ways, learning about cultura and tradition here in 2021.
Angel Peña is president of the Nuestra Tierra Conservation Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. Truly, sir. Appreciate you.
You can watch the full interview with Angel Peña on the Fronteras page in the local TV section at krwg.org. And a program note, tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV, join us for Issues and Answers, Cannabis Legalization. New Mexico is joining neighboring states Colorado and Arizona by making adult-use cannabis legal. Sales are expected to start next year. What will the change mean for the state? We will talk with producers and state legislators to hear their views. Issues and Answers, Cannabis Legalization, tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. That's KRWG News this week, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.